This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
I've bridged between Portland and Vancouver today with a vote of 18 to 11. The approved expenditure of $450 million will go to Governor John Kitzhaber, who is expected to sign it. The total cost of the bridge will be $3.4 billion. Proponents of the bridge say that it is needed to ease traffic congestion between Portland and Vancouver and that it will aid interstate commerce. Critics of the bridge say it's unnecessary and that estimates of bridge traffic will not meet the estimated total in order to have toll revenue pay for the bridge, a major selling point made by bridge backers like Kitzhaber and contractors. Republican Senator Tim Knope voiced concern for the bill during debate today on the Senate floor.
With House Bill 2800, I believe we need to answer three important questions on this legislation. Do we need a new bridge and updates to the traffic issues surrounding the Port of Portland in order to grow Oregon's trade economy and create jobs? Is there another alternative with bipartisan support that can unite nearly all business and labor in support of it? And lastly, are Oregon taxpayers protected? I could not vote for House Bill 2800 because it lacked protections. However, 2800A is the bill before us today. It has been amended and has several protections that won't allow the project to happen if finances truly don't add up. And who's the person that has to sign off on this? It's our state treasurer. Treasurer Ted Wheeler has a bachelor's degree in economics from Stanford, an MBA from Columbia, and a master's degree in public policy from Harvard. I believe our state treasurer is more than qualified to review the financing on this project before it goes forward. If it doesn't add up, I'm confident the treasurer will work to protect Oregon taxpayers just like I will, which is the very reason these provisions were added to the bill.
Also voting in favor of the bill was Democratic Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, who represents West Portland and Beaverton.
With regard to Washington's component of this funding, I'm concerned about the deadlines posed. While Washington's legislature adjourns in mid-April and will hopefully have approved their portion of the funding by now, it is not unheard of for citizen initiatives to overturn such approvals by the legislature, and what would happen were that to occur after September 30th. Finally, while I have been assured by the carrier that the Congress has never refused to approve a grant requested by the Department of Transportation, we live in somewhat precarious times when it comes to the function of our federal legislature, and I want to be sure that we don't have a commitment from the grant, but not actually the funding approval. I have a range of other concerns, including effects on public health, displacement of local communities, and traffic displacement. I will be watching these closely, and I will be a reluctant aye vote for House Bill 28.
Senator Bruce Starr, representing Hillsborough, supported the bill and claimed that it was important to listen to Clark County's desire for light rail, even though residents of Clark County previously voted against light rail from Vancouver to Portland.
There are folks that are opposed to the project. I understand that. But this is one of those unique situations where you have a compromise. You have a unique political culture in Portland. And I appreciate that. Colleagues on this floor that represent that culture and those constituents very well. There's a different culture, perhaps, in Clark County, City of Vancouver. In order to bring those cultures together, you have to compromise. The compromise is that you marry light rail with a bridge with a lot of lanes and a lot of capacity, in order so that we can accommodate the billions of dollars of freight that moves over that bridge every year, the tens of thousands of jobs that are dependent on that freight movement. Will there be folks that are impacted negatively by this? There's no question. Anytime you build a project of this size, you're going to impact folks in a negative way. There's no question about that. But you look at the big picture, colleagues, the large picture, and that's the thousands of lives that will be improved because of the work that will go on as this bridge gets built, the capacities that are generated.
Jackie Dingfelder, who represents Northeast and Southeast Portland, was one of 11 senators who voted against the bill.
My district is bisected by two major highways, I-205 and I-84. Both of these highways are congested many hours of the day, and I would guess that almost all of you have probably spent time sitting in the middle of my district in your car during these times of congestion. So the concerns that I have is about the potential increased congestion in my district, because during increasingly longer portions of every day, including sometime on weekends, and then happened to me this weekend, unfortunately, these congested freeways can be a parking lot right in the middle of my district. This bill under Section 19 calls for a study to look at mitigating traffic problems that will be created as a result of tolling I-5 without also tolling I-205. I've looked at that information, I've looked at the modeling data, and I am skeptical of the results showing minimal impacts to my district. And diverting more traffic from I-5 will lead to increased congestion, not only on I-205, but also I-84. Northeast Sandy Boulevard, also running right through my district, Gleason and 82nd Avenue, and other surface streets that cross through the heart of my district. That means more dangerous streets and diminished air qualities, which impacts health and well-being of my constituents. Another significant concern I have, and it's already been addressed by another member here, is the proposed funding mechanism of this project without a designated long-term source of revenue. And I emphasize long-term because what I've been told is the federal funds that are available will run out after the first 3 years. Oregon is already facing serious transportation funding challenges, and we have no assurances about the impact this project will have on ODOT's ability to address safety and infrastructure problems on other state-owned highways.
While Monday's vote gives the new I-5 bridge the go-ahead from the Oregon side, the project depends on the Washington State Legislature approving its share of the funding, which equals $450 million. The federal government must also approve over $1 billion of additional funding, and the Coast Guard also has to approve the project. The Coast Guard is currently considering approval of the bridge's clearance, 116 feet, which is still too short for large shipping vessels used by industries that are upstream from the bridge.
The U.S. State Department has issued an environmental impact statement claiming that the Keystone XL pipeline will not cause significant harm to the environment. All of the nation's largest environmental groups have issued statements condemning the report. And 350.org, an international environmental organization focused on climate change, has called for national strategy sessions to be held across the country this week. Oil Change International says that the State Department's report ignores the fact that the pipeline is likely to trigger at least 450,000 barrels per day of additional tar sands production in Alberta. The group also says that by dismissing emissions associated with petroleum coke carried by the pipeline, the State Department is underestimating the climate emissions of the pipeline by at least 13%. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Tyson Slocum with Public Citizen, one of the groups that opposes the Keystone XL pipeline.
What are the main problems with the environmental impact statement that was issued on Friday by the State Department?
Well, it underestimated the impact the Keystone Pipeline would have in increasing the rate of tar sands production in Canada.
What are some of the impacts of the proposed Keystone XL pipeline?
Well, the Keystone Pipeline seeks to move tar sands synthetic crude from the Canadian border down to oil refineries in the Gulf Coast of the United States. We are already receiving 1 million barrels of Canadian crude every day, but all of that is processed at oil refineries in the Midwestern United States. The Midwest produces gasoline for domestic consumption because it's in the middle of the country. With U.S. oil consumption flat, oil companies are seeking to boost profits by exporting more refined products like gasoline and diesel. And that's where this Keystone Pipeline comes in. It seeks to move an additional 830,000 barrels of oil each day from Canada down to the Gulf Coast, where the majority of that oil will be refined for export out of the United States.
What about the claim by the State Department that this project will not significantly affect the level of development of the tar sands in Alberta?
Well, I think that's false speculation on the part of the State Department. The fact is that the Keystone Pipeline will be the only primary conduit by which to export Canadian tar sands oil to the coast. This is the central component of Canadian export strategy, and as a result, approval of the Keystone Pipeline is essential for increased rate of development of the tar sands.
Now, last year, President Obama blocked the approval of the pipeline, but seems to be moving towards, again, approving this pipeline. What impact will this statement, the EIS by the State Department, have on Obama's decision?
Well, first we have to remember that last year Obama did not block the pipeline. All he said was that the current application needed to be refiled, and he said publicly at the time that he welcomed and encouraged the company to reapply for various technical reasons. The Obama administration has never once said that they have concerns about climate change from the Keystone Pipeline, and the administration has never said that they oppose this pipeline.
That was Tyson Slocum with Public Citizen speaking to KBOO's Jenka Soderberg about the Keystone XL pipeline.
The First Unitarian Church is hosting the group Move to Amend and their barnstorming tour tonight, beginning at 7 p.m. The event is a combination workshop and presentation designed to empower members of the community who want to see the Supreme Court Citizens United decision overturned. KBOO's Robin Ryan spoke with Move to Amend's national organizer, Ashley Sanders, about the event.
What can people learn as a result of the workshop?
Basically, in the workshop, we dig into the true origins of the Constitution. You know, in school, we normally hear about the Constitution as this great document of liberty and equality, but we talk about the economic motivations behind the passage of the Constitution, and the Constitution as kind of a counter-revolutionary document that actually kind of ensconced the wealth of a lot of wealthy people, but also the promises of the revolutionary movement during that period and what people fought for in terms of people's rights and limiting the power of economic elites and economic institutions over their lives. And we fast forward to the current day and talk about the rise of corporate capitalism and the way that it threatens human rights and threatens our planet and threatens our democracy, and what people can do to dismantle the idea that corporations are people that can spend unlimited amounts of money in our elections, so that we can make the first step into having a broader conversation of what we would have to do nationwide to actually control corporations and create a democracy that works for people.
When and how did corporations become a legal person?
A lot of people have heard of the Citizens United decision in 2010 that allowed corporations to spend unlimited amounts of money in our election cycles, but actually the history of corporate personhood goes back much further, and the Supreme Court actually granted corporations human rights in 1886 in a court case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, and it was a really boring court case about railroad taxes, but corporate executives and lawyers basically use these boring cases as ways to get into the courts and say, don't do this, do this, and by the way, we're people under the law and you have to treat us equally. And that's what they did with Santa Clara County, and it basically got through the legal system and went down on the records as corporations having human rights, and corporations immediately seized on that and used it to build a case for getting all these other rights that are only supposed to belong to humans under the Bill of Rights. So basically, the story of the United States is a story of disenfranchised groups of people trying to count as legal persons so that they can get acknowledged and get rights. And corporations knew that if they could get that same boost, that they would be basically unstoppable. So that's why they went after that and have been building that case for the last 150 years.
Share with our listeners when and where you're going to be in town.
So I will be in Portland on Monday, and I will be doing a public presentation from 7 p.m. to 8:30 at the Unitarian Church on 13th Street, and I will be discussing dismantling corporate rule and creating genuine democracy, and anyone and everybody is invited to come out. You can also check out movetoamend.org to learn more about our organization and see how you can get involved in the local affiliate in your area.
That's movetoamend.org. And we've been talking with Ashley Sanders. This is Robin Ryan for KBOO News.
A new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation says the number of young people in juvenile detention has been decreasing over the last 18 years. Oregon's 16% decline is less than half the national rate of 40%, partly the result of the state's so-called tough-on-crime mandatory minimum sentences. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Matt Maddox reports.
In Oregon, 16% fewer juveniles are being incarcerated compared to 20 years ago, but nationally, the drop is 40%. A new report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation analyzes data from 1997 to 2010. It says most states have expanded community-based alternatives to locking kids up, but there's still a long way to go. David Rogers, who heads the Partnership for Safety and Justice, says Oregon is out of step with what research says works for kids because of mandatory minimum sentencing laws that treat them as adults when they're charged with a serious offense.
We know that the best thing that we can do is to rehabilitate them so that they can become productive members of society. But placing youth in the adult system and giving them an adult felony conviction actually takes them in the opposite direction. It's a very serious problem.
Oregon passed a law in 2011 requiring that kids be held in juvenile facilities instead of adult jails, but Rogers says there hasn't been any funding to create those facilities in many communities. The report recommends incarceration only for youth who pose a threat to public safety, and small, treatment-oriented facilities for those who must be confined. A joint legislative committee is studying alternatives from the Governor's Commission on Public Safety. Rogers says for juveniles, one recommendation creates a set of hearings for a young offender sentenced as an adult so a judge can periodically re-examine their progress.
If that young person is doing well, a judge could allow them to be moved into mandatory community supervision and avoid getting transferred to adult prison. And that's a step in the right direction.
Laura Speer with the Casey Foundation says about three-quarters of kids in detention are there for non-violent offenses. And the research shows locking them up only makes them more likely to reoffend.
They have a chance to get their lives back on track, and so we want to make sure they get put in the best possible program to get them back on track.
The report also calls attention to a racial gap in the juvenile justice system. It says Latino and American Indian kids are 2 to 3 times more likely to be incarcerated than their white peers, and for African American kids, 5 times more likely. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, this is Matt Maddox with KBOO News.
Oregon's budget was released today, with schools getting a much-needed boost and state employees losing benefits. The budget, which covers 2013 to 2015, allocates $6.5 billion for schools, with an additional $200 million going to districts based on cuts from public employee pensions. The budget was released by Senator Richard Devlin of Tualatin and Representative Peter Buckley of Ashland, both co-chairs of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. In Oregon's budget process, state representatives vote on agency budgets individually, but spending must conform to the guidelines laid out by the budget plan. The spending for school represents a billion-dollar increase over the last two-year period and $400 million more than Governor John Kitzhaber allotted to schools in his proposed budget last November. Costs related to the public employees' retirement system have been a hot-button issue for some time. The cuts to the system known as PERS were no surprise. Teachers and state workers' unions have vowed to resist the cuts. The budget also decreased spending for prisons, part of the governor's efforts to reduce prison sentences as a way to ease Oregon spending.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues, at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. In tonight's show, we hear from a woman who shot her abusive husband, was sentenced to life in prison, and then had her murder conviction overturned. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be cloudy throughout the day with scattered showers, highs near 46 degrees. Rain should continue into the evening, lows around 42.
It's 5:22 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The word of the day is boom. Yes, boom times are upon us again. The stars came into alignment, marveled one financial manager. Corporate confidence returns, applauded a recent headline. We're finally dusting off the cobwebs, rejoiced a business analyst, pointing out that banks are willing to take risks. Well, it's about time that bankers and CEOs began turning loose of some of the trillions of dollars they've been hoarding. Since the crash of 2008, grassroots America has been starved of investment and job-creating enterprises. So any sign of that long-dormant capital finally beginning to move would be splendid news indeed. Except for this nagging question. Where's the money going? Hint, not to you. The big money is not being invested in job growth, grassroots enterprise, new products, or anything else that would improve your family's economic prospects. Rather, this boom is truly explosive, a job-destroying financial flimflam known grandly as the corporate merger. It amounts to nothing more than one giant corporation taking over another, or even a corporation taking over itself. The mega merger is back, exclaimed the New York Times. I'll say, already this year, $11 billion was spent to merge U.S. Air into American Airlines. Warren Buffett and a Brazilian buyout group threw $23 billion into the purchase of ketchup peddler H.J. Heinz. And Michael Dell amassed $24 billion to buy his namesake computer outfit, which he already was in charge of and owned the biggest chunk of. This is Jim Hightower saying this buyout boom is a boon to the financial hucksters and top executives who profit from the deals, but merger mania cuts jobs, shrinks competition, raises consumer prices, concentrates wealth in fewer hands, and diverts capital from productive enterprises. What a deal for America!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
An Occupy Wall Street spinoff group has filed a lawsuit against the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, which regulates stock exchanges in the U.S. Two members of Occupy the SEC filed a lawsuit to try to force the federal government to enforce the Volcker Rule, which was passed by Congress in 2010. The Volcker Rule is supposed to block retail banks from acting as investment banks and prohibit them from making speculative trades with investors' money. But the Securities and Exchange Commission has failed to properly enforce the rule. Members of Occupy the SEC contend they are at risk of losing money as customers of JP Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo if authorities don't implement the law. They are suing the SEC and a number of other government agencies to try to force them to do their jobs. Last year, Occupy the SEC submitted a 325-page comment letter petitioning the agencies responsible to begin enforcing the rule, but the SEC refused to create a timeline to begin enforcement.
Swiss voters today overwhelmingly endorsed curbs on executive pay, with 68% of voters approving a measure that would give shareholders a veto for executive compensation and ban excessive CEO severance packages. Swiss outrage at underperforming companies such as Novartis and UBS precipitated the measure, which will now be included in Switzerland's constitution and apply to all businesses listed in the National Stock Exchange. The so-called Fat Cat Initiative will make Switzerland's corporate rules perhaps the strongest in the world and come just days after the European Union approved a 27-country cap on bankers' bonuses.
In Moscow, a politically tinged play was interrupted yesterday when Russian police officers and immigration officials barged into the production, demanding to see the director's documents. The play was a three-day reenactment of court trials held against Russian artists, including the band Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot received international attention last year when they staged a performance with anti-Putin sentiments at a Moscow cathedral that led to the arrest of three of the members on charges of, quote, hooliganism. Last October, two of the band members, both young mothers, were sentenced to 2 years imprisonment at labor camps. Amnesty International lists both activists as prisoners of conscience. Yesterday, senior officials from the Federal Migration Service claimed they stormed the theater production in order to warn the director, who's from Switzerland, that he was not allowed to work in the country. But the raid proved futile when the Swiss theater director's work visa turned out to be in full order. The director said, quote, "My impression was they had absolutely no plan. They just wanted to interrupt the production and helplessly searched for a reason."
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, March 4th, 2013. Israeli troops arrest 17 Palestinians during drone invasions and political detainees held by Israel implement a one-day hunger strike. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Palestinian Minister for Detainees, Isa Karakeh, stated on Monday that the Palestinian detainees in the Jalbu'ah Israeli prison are holding a one-day hunger strike as an initial step, part of activities in support of hunger-striking detainees and to protest the ongoing Israeli violations. Karakeh said that 120 to 140 detainees in Jalbu'ah declared strike and returned their meals as part of further steps. That also comes in retaliation to the death of detainee Arafat Jaradat, who was tortured to death. Jaradat, 33, from Sa'ir town near Hebron City, was kidnapped by the army on February 18 and was subjected to extreme torture that led to his death in the Israeli interrogation facility on Saturday, February 23, 2013. Furthermore, Karakeh said that on Sunday at night, the army broke into Section 11 of the Negev detention camp and attacked several detainees. In other news, 17 Palestinians were arrested on Monday by Israeli troops during morning and dawn invasions targeting a number of West Bank communities. Palestinian sources said that Israeli troops invaded southern West Bank city of Hebron and the nearby Al-Arub town, searched homes, then arrested 11 men and took them to unknown location. Also in southern West Bank, Israeli troops stormed the city of Bethlehem and arrested a young man after searching his home. Meanwhile, in the northern West Bank city of Jenin, Israeli soldiers searched homes and arrested two men. Another four men were taken by the Israeli soldiers during an invasion targeting the nearby Qalqilya city. Later on Monday, clashes erupted between local youth and Israeli soldiers at the southern entrance of Jenin city. Local sources said that Israeli soldiers used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets against the unarmed Palestinian youth. No injuries or arrests were reported. Over the weekend, a group of fundamentalist Israeli settlers assaulted on Sunday three Palestinian schoolchildren in Jaba' village, north of occupied East Jerusalem. The three are brothers. This is the second attack against them since Thursday. Mahmoud Abu Ghayya, a resident of Al-Jahaleen Bedouin village, stated that the settlers attacked three schoolchildren while walking to school, inflicting various injuries. The army arrived at the scene and prevented Yahya Habayib, a local reporter working for Ajyar Radio, from documenting the attack and confiscated his camera. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, March 4th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura. We'll be right back.
are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-321-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Matt Maddox, Mike Klepfer, Robin Ryan, Quinn Reed, and Angelica O'Rourke. The producer is Serena Fong. Special thanks to reporters, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KABU News and Evening Affairs Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representative about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, hear Abe Proctor and Joe Uris.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, activist and lawyer David Cobb speaks on Move to Amend. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
And at 11 on Stage and Studio, take a look at Soweilu Theater's Hard Times Come Again No More by Martha Basing. Host D-May Roberts speaks with Soweilu's Lorraine Barr and Martha Basing. Plus, a writer's read segment on with Bing Bingham in Antelope, Oregon. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Miles Cleveland Goodwin about his new painting show, A Long Road Home.